Have you ever wondered what it's like to witness a murder?
Forrest grabbed the knife and then just stabbed Johnny in one motion.
Or how it feels to be shot?
I was immediately hit by a barrage of bullets.
Or how you would react if your spouse hired someone to kill you?
And he was to put me in a grave with a bullet wound on my head.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a stalking victim.
Came back upstairs, and when I came back and turned the corner into my room, I saw him standing there.
You'll hear from a man who was kidnapped and tortured.
I would do anything, say anything, to simply get away.
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app, or at whatwasthatlike.com.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that the following story contains the names of people who have died. This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. Please take care of yourself.
So now we're going to get into Dennis Doombeery Rostron's early life. So he was born the son of Mandarg of the Balang clan of Eastern Arnhem Land to the son Totem. Mandarg was born in 1915, had four, possibly five wives and 18 children total. And by the way, you know, polyamory in Aboriginal Australian culture is complex. So it's not like just it's a different culture, so we think of it differently.
Yes.
But Dennis was his 12th child, born to his first wife, Rosie Maljabi, in 1963.
Rosie was born in 1925, and she was a strong-willed woman. By the 1970s, she had separated from Mandarg, set up a home on the other side of the camp, and announced, quote, "I am now divorced," unquote.
I love it. I love that so much. Put it on a t-shirt. She encouraged her daughters to be independent as well. If they had any trouble with their men, they were encouraged to leave and come back to stay with their mother. Her daughters were described as spirited, whereas her sons were described as laid back.
Mandarg has been described as a dominant father with unquestionable authority. His sons went to him for advice and they, quote, followed his orders without delay, unquote.
Dennis wasn't the only son of Mandarg who got himself into some trouble. In December of 1966, another son, David Galbuma, 19, murdered a woman and attacked her six-year-old cousin because he was with her. The boy survived. This was to be considered one of the last ritual spearing murders in Arnhem Land.
During the trial, it came out that he was ordered to kill the woman by his elders because she was suspected of having a role in the deaths of her husband and their two newborn children, although the deaths could have been attributed to disease.
The prosecutor suggested an alternate motivation, that David had wanted to marry the woman, but was thwarted because she was the wrong skin type. This was described as the quote-unquote white explanation, having to do more with, quote, white wishes than black reality, unquote. And that quote took my breath away.
Yeah, really.
It's just a complete lack of cultural competency.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it makes me think back on some other cases that we covered.
Yeah.
And the explanations for why they did things. And we might have been completely wrong.
Yeah. Seriously. I wonder who, if anybody took the time to, like, you know, ask. That's another thing I noticed too about in this research is everybody's like, what are we going to do about the Aboriginal problem? Oh, they must like being poor. They must like their circumstances. It's their fault, like punishing them. But nobody has asked them what they needed. Like all these programs and government people who are coming
trying
in,
to fix them, but not asking them what the actual problem
what
is.
What do you need? Hey,
yeah.
What do you
You're
need
asking
done?
The wrong question. It makes me think of Night Country.
Yeah. And it just reminds me of something we've said and we've heard listeners say when we get it wrong, like not about us, without us. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
Just cultural competencies. Quite important. That's all I'm trying to say, and I'm going to shut up now. Promise.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries. Okay. Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So nice. I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah, I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. The thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering.
Yeah.
And it can help you become the bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's better, HELP.com/fruit.
Something is creeping. Don't follow it down.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorized financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy. And you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
It was all fictitious.
You stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt Clooghless.
So David was found guilty, but the judge took into consideration his Aboriginal culture and beliefs, and he was sentenced to only 4 years.
I think that's really interesting, too, that judges do that.
Yeah.
Dennis Rostron had a bit of history of flying off the handle. In 1985, he was 21. He got into an argument with Rebecca Judge Amir over her refusal to make tea. He picked up a shotgun and fired it over her head.
Oh,
her father, George, took her away to live somewhere else.
Probably
Ooh,
a good choice.
Bullet
yeah.
dodged. literally. So now let's get into the timeline. Hit it, Beth.
In 1988, Rostron, who was 24 at the time, was living with his wife, Cecily, 23, and their two sons, Preston, 3, and Zarak, 21 months, at Malgawa, Cecily's parents' outstation.
Dick Murumuru was a well-known artist from Oipeli. He and his wife, Dolly, moved to Malgawa to be with family and to get away from outside influences. He was described as, quote-unquote, happy fella, who enjoyed painting and hunting.
Dick and old Lofty Najambarek, another artist and elder in the community, both felt it was their duty to look after their traditional homeland. They were a permanent fixture at the outstation.
Rostron later said that he was worried about the marriage. He said that he was crying sometimes, feeling sad, and thinking about killing himself. Tension between Rostron and his father-in-law, Dick Murumuru, as well as constant arguments with Cecily, filled him with anger.
It has been reported that the week before the murders, Rostron and Dick argued when Dick accused Rostron of speaking to his wife, Dolly, which was forbidden under the tribal avoidance practices, because Dolly was his mother-in-law.
Okay, got it. Thank you. Cecily was away at the time, and when she returned, she sided with her father, culminating in her telling Rostron that their sons were not actually his. That's a hell of a piece of news to deliver.
Yeah.
The family then isolated Rostron and would not let him near the children or give him food over a period of a couple of days.
On Friday, September 23rd, Cecily left for Jabiru to sell some of her father's paintings and to pick up some supplies. In order to get in and out of the outstation, they used chartered planes. Before she flew out, Rostron asked her to pick up some batteries for his tape recorder.
You know, I was just thinking, like, I had to go today to the post office for a show. And it was like the mental preparation that I had to do. And then I had to go to a second store. And like, it was too much. If I had to be, if I had to get on a plane just
to do
for
those
supplies, I don't know if I could do it.
Of course, you probably wouldn't do it that often. So
I
that might make up for it.
I guess, but I'm just saying that, oh gosh, I'm so spoiled. I'm so privileged in so many ways. Wow. So in Jabiru, Cecily sold the paintings and then went to the supermarket to buy groceries, but she forgot the batteries. Then she flew back to Malgawa.
When Rostron found out that she had forgotten the batteries, he became angry. Cecily apologized, but he grabbed her around the neck and pushed her.
Mm.
Dick then intervened, spoke strongly to Rostron, and got his son-in-law to calm down.
The next day was better. Rostron went hunting and shot two emu. When you live in the bush, a good hunt makes people very happy. Rostron was pleased with himself, and Dick was too. But the next day, September 25th, Rostron was angry with Cecily again when she didn't cook his breakfast.
This soon gave way to his anger over the batteries again. Once more, Dick intervened, pointing out that there were very few people living at Magawa and they needed to get along.
It was very hot that day, 45 degrees Celsius or 113 Fahrenheit. Dick was resting in the shade. Rostron and Cecily also rested in the shade, but continued to squabble. Suddenly, Rostron rose, walked off, and then came back with a shotgun.
The first blast went over Cecily's head. Cecily shielded her two children in her arms as Rostron reloaded and shot her dead. He then reloaded again and shot both of his sons, Preston 3 and Zorak, 21 months.
The idea of doing that to such a small, like, human body is horrifying.
Yeah, I can't even.
Yeah, thank you. Took the words out of my mouth. So he then shot Dick and Dolly. Witnesses said that by this point, Rostron was screaming, but there were no words. Rostron also shot a number of other people, or he shot at a number of other people at the outstation as they fled, but he did not hit anyone else.
Esau Judjimir and his cousin Abraham, both 12, Shirley Judjimir and Natricia Norarga, both 16, and two of the elders, Lena Norarga and Andrew Norarga, all fled. Rostron shot at Andrew as he ran, but missed him. However, shortly afterwards, Andrew dropped dead of a heart attack.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
The rest headed east as Rostron headed west. They set off on foot without food or water across the Arnhem Land in escarpment. Remember, it's really, really hot. They emerged at a mining camp 3 days later, 80 kilometers or 50 miles away. So now let's get into the investigation and the arrest. What do you got for us, Beth?
On Tuesday, September 27th, Old Lofty's daughter, June Nanjambarak, flew into Malgawa. She was a nurse and was there to conduct medical checkups. When the plane landed at the airstrip, nobody came to meet it, which was unusual. June then walked down to the settlement and found the bodies.
The pilot radioed Jabiru with the news. An early rumor among the Aborigines blamed white shooters from a buffalo eradication program. But when it was learned that Rostron was not among the dead, and people remembered how he had shot above the head of Rebecca Judjimir with a shotgun, they began to suspect that he was involved.
So the initial thought that it was white people was not,
it's not unusual. it's not out of the question. Yeah, I mean, again, often white people were continuing to, like, bother them.
Right.
And, again, come in, you know, guns blazing, like, I'm the whites. The whites are here.
Yeah.
And that, you know, like, making decisions, picking up people, just disrupting their lives.
Yeah. The immediate impulse was to get Rostron. In tribal custom, it's an eye for an eye. One of the elders said, quote, in law, if someone to do that out in the bush and a lot of people are around, they would do the same thing to him. You know, just take his life, same as what he did. unquote.
Rostron had headed northwest toward Korlo Birada, his family's camp, about 50 kilometers or 32 miles from Malgawa. For several days, he hid in the bush near Korlo Birada. He still had the shotgun. It is believed that he spent that time trying to figure out what to do, surrender or keep hiding.
Police set up operations in Malgawa, bringing in men and equipment via a cargo plane. They began a ground and air search using helicopters. The people of Arnhem Land had never seen such intense police activity, and many were frightened.
I was also going to say, police activity costs money.
Yeah.
Can you imagine
a lot of money
if
was
the
spent.
Money they had used to try to catch this person or go into these communities had been used to just give it to them and help instead of all the other stuff? Just wonder.
Yeah.
When police came to Korlo Birada to search, Rostron's mother, Rosie Maljabi, fled into the bush. She was never seen again. Or at least she was still missing in 2021, which is the last that I can find mention of her.
Yeah, so if she's been found, let us know.
Yes, please.
Yeah. At 9:30 p.m. October 4th, Rostron walked into Meningrida, 65 kilometers or 40 miles north of Korlo Birada. He had a meal with a relative and then turned himself into the police. He was charged the next morning with 5 counts of murder.
All right, so now we're going to get into the trial. Let me tell you, so Rostron admitted to the killings but pleaded not guilty to the murder on the basis of diminished responsibility related to depression, impairing his capacity, and provocation. In 1990, Rostron was tried and found guilty on 5 counts of murder and sentenced to life in prison with no prospect of parole.
However, in 2003, he became eligible for parole following changes to life sentencing laws, which allowed people who had been sentenced to life in prison for multiple murders to be given a non-parole period of 25 years.
Okay. In 2013, his non-parole period was increased to 28 years by Northern Territory Supreme Court Justice Judith Kelly following a request from the Director of Public Prosecutions. In handing down her decision in 2013, Justice Judith Kelly, say that 5 times fast, said, quote, I am satisfied that because of the objective and subjective factors affecting the relative seriousness of the offense, a non-parole period longer than 25 years is warranted, unquote.
Justice Kelly also told the court that she would have given Rostron a longer non-parole period if he was not an Aboriginal man. Quote, the life expectancy of Aboriginal men is 52.5 years. For non-Aboriginal territory men, 64.7.
Wow.
If it had not been for Mr. Rostron's ill health and the concomitant risk that a very long non-parole period may well be an actual life sentence for him, I would have considered a non-parole period of at least 30 years to be warranted, unquote.
Yeah, but I don't know how, I mean, that stat that of life expectancy is quite grim.
Staggering.
Yeah. So, and that's,
I'd be dead already.
That, yeah. Oh my God. But a lot of the life expectancy issues have to do with racism.
Yeah.
And racism impact on bodies that are not white. But the judge also commented on his situation leading up to the horrific mass shooting. Quote, his marriage was breaking down. He was being treated badly by his wife and his in-laws and excluded from the family. And his parental right to his own children was being challenged, unquote.
At the time, Justice Kelly said she was not prepared to make a finding he would not reoffend, adding, quote, I accept he has incentive not to reoffend, but one would have thought he had even stronger incentive before, natural love and affection for his children, unquote.
That is a pickle.
Yeah.
Rostron had been in custody since he turned himself into authorities in September of 1988, making him one of the Northern Territory's longest serving prisoners. So now we're going to get into where are they now? Tell us, Beth.
Dennis Rostron became eligible for parole after he had served 28 years in prison. The parole was granted in 2019 when he was 55. On granting his parole, the judge, Justice Southwood, reportedly insisted the community had been consulted about his release at length and now supported the decision.
The parole board was reportedly satisfied that Rostron had obtained a low security rating, had completed required rehabilitation and reintegration programs, and had a realistic post-release plan, including the ability to earn an income from the sales of his art, In prison, Rostron learned to read and write and taught other inmates how to paint.
Today, Rostron lives in an outstation near Maningrida with his extended family. He's employed doing activity work, and I'm not 100% sure what that is, but a little Googling suggests that it's temporary work for specified activities. So he might do some labor here, some labor there.
A little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And he also sells his artwork across the territory.
Aha. Uh-huh. A family relation who refers to him as Grandpa said they all felt extremely happy when Dennis came home. Quote, "He's happy every day. He's happy being with us families and he lives with us," unquote.
I want to take a moment to tell you about my podcast, Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage. In 1984, a woman named Phyllis Cottle was abducted in broad daylight, tortured, and left to die in a burning car in Akron, Ohio. At the time, I was a rookie reporter covering this horrific story. Since then, I've reported every kind of crime imaginable. I've been able to leave most of them at work, but not this one, the one that buried itself under my skin and stayed put. Phyllis Cottle was a badass woman, and I want to tell you her story. A production of Evergreen Podcasts and signature title of the Killer Podcast Network, you can find Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage wherever you get your podcasts. Discover more great true crime and paranormal programming at killerpodcast.com.
So now we're going to get into our thoughts. Beth, I'm sure you got some spicy hot takes on this case. So what do you think about this?
So not knowing, we briefly went over the Aboriginal culture, but, you know, I've never met an Australian Aboriginal person. I don't know the culture inside and out, never lived there, never been there.
Yeah.
So I don't, you know, I don't know exactly. I do know that this was shocking for everybody, this crime, the Aboriginal people, the Europeans, everybody. And I wonder if living at his wife's outstation with his wife's family, there weren't a lot of people there, and the people who lived there were not his family.
Yeah.
I wonder if he felt isolated.
I think so, too. I also, you know, I didn't know that he was illiterate. And I also wonder.
I didn't either until, anyway, go ahead.
Well, I just think that that may have added to the isolation.
Yeah.
I don't know if the other people around him were also illiterate, but my suspicion was that can be isolating as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like he didn't know what to do with his anger. Like he'd pop off.
Right. Right.
He had no
outlet. Or
outlet.
Ways of coping that may have been healthy.
Coping skills.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what we learned about his early life, his mom taught his sisters to be independent. But what did she teach her sons? And what is his father teach them? I don't know.
I don't know either.
Great
question. Yeah.
And it sounds like when this occurred, he was out of his mind with rage. And this is not an excuse, just an observation. I mean, he was described as screaming as he shot the family, but not saying anything, just screaming.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it sounds like he... Go ahead.
I'm so sorry to cut you off, but about they didn't feed him for days. So lack of food, isolation, and frustration, that could drive anybody mad.
Poor relationship with his wife and his in-laws and living at this outstation where his family was not. All of that was probably stressors.
Yeah.
And he never learned how to cope with his emotions.
Yeah, I think that you're right. Agreed. I had many thoughts about this case. First of all, racism in Australia is fucking wild in that they essentially did the things that all the other Western nations did to Indigenous and Black people in their countries.
Yeah.
Took their land, enslaved them, kept them from resources and rights, disenfranchised them, And Australia is doing something similar that we are doing here. And that's trying to not talk about it and take it out of all of the history
trying
books.
Trying to pretend, yeah, it,
pretend
never
it
happened.
Didn't happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like there's this day called the Australia Day. And they celebrate the formation of Australia. And
right.
Aboriginal people aren't getting down with that. It's a celebration for who? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And let's see. What else did I thought that you already haven't said? You know, I was just going to say he fled immediately because he mm-hmm. knew what he did was wrong. And yeah. he stayed hidden for over a week.
Yeah, because it looks like it was like 10 days.
Because he knew yeah. what he did was wrong. And I am always surprised and fascinated by the I blacked out defense. You know, I've never been that angry where I don't remember being angry.
What I did.
And if I'm being honest, I've never had the freedom to do that because I'm a black woman in America.
Yeah.
But I do like envy people who are just allowed to get mad and be mad yeah. in public yeah. and break things and throw things. And that's it's so wrapped up in that emotion that you can't remember what you're doing, despite it being horrifying and really bad. It's just,
yeah,
I don't know what to make of it. I'm not smart enough. But I did have thoughts about it. What else? I just like he could have done so many other things. Like he got out of prison and he said, I saw a quote, "I'm a good person," he said. But gosh, if only you had come to that realization earlier, you know,
yeah.
then this.
You're
tragedy.
A good person except for
except,
the murdering.
Yeah.
yeah.
And that's
except
another
that.
Yeah. Another thing about language, not to beat a dead horse because we try to get things right here, but it might be better to refer to him rather as a murderer or people who kill and who people are capable of change, a person who murders. I've heard prison abolitionists talk about that conversation about not calling people murderers or rapists, but calling them people who do a certain thing. There might be some mixed reviews and opinions about that thought.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
in this sense, he did a horrible thing. He spent a lot of time in prison and now he's out, presumably not doing other horrible things.
Hopefully not.
So
yeah.
does the title still apply? I don't know.
I hope for his family's sake that he's changed.
Me too. And
yeah.
Also,
and he may have learned a lot of coping skills in jail. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. And also just don't want to forget the impact that this had on the family and the community.
Yeah.
In which the people who were killed
yeah,
lost their
lives. Yeah, actually, Malgawa no longer exists.
What?
Because, yeah, they abandoned it
oh.
after this happened.
As I said, when somebody dies, the whole family dies
yeah.
and they leave.
And yes.
Yeah.
And it was their home. Yeah.
yeah.
They just left.
Oh, that's
sad.
It's like a devastating cherry on top of a devastating sundae.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Well, now let us know what you think of the case. And if anything we left out that you think is important, feel free to get at us and let us know. Beth, where can the people find us?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media.
This is a weekly podcast, and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
My name is Bill Huffman, and I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast, Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic, and now each week I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an evergreen podcast, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get 6,000 cash, give us each 3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com or wherever fine podcasts are found.